supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. I am thrilled to be back in this seat after a long, long, long absence. Well, the Australian Theatre Company, Back to Back Theatre, brings its production of Food Court to the Kimmel this month as part of the Philadelphia Live Arts Festival. If you go, expect to be pulled into something unfamiliar and at times uncomfortable. For one thing, the story is the work of a group of actors perceived as having intellectual disabilities. But with unparalleled honesty, characters in the play spell out intolerance for others who are, quote, different. They open harsh discourse about body image. They express unmet sexual needs. And there's a ganging up that doesn't just marginalize one of the characters, it nearly destroys her. On today's show, we're going to use the play Food Court as a pivot point to discuss what it means to have an intellectual disability. We'll talk about finding ways to thrive within families and communities, about self-perception and social perception. I'll introduce my guests in just a moment, but first, our producer, Jennifer Lynn, recently spoke with Bruce Gladwin. He's the artistic director of Food Court. She spoke with him to get a sense of how this unusual show actually works.
Tell me about the actors who perform in Food Court.
We have six actors who are all perceived to have an intellectual disability. We don't have the right to ask the actors what sort of disability they have. For some of the actors in the company, there's two actors with Down syndrome, it's quite clear. For some of the other actors, I'm still not fully aware what their specific disability is.
I don't pick you up. Look at you!
The subject matter in the play Food Court is very raw. Characters jeer at and abuse another character. They debase her. They treat her like a hated, worthless object. What's your sense of how the actors in the ensemble can handle these roles? Do you think they understand the action and the script?
You know, they go on an emotional ride. And we use a process of improvisation as the creation of the script. And so we've got to that final script through a huge amount of discussion. We've got like hours and hours and hours, hundreds of hours of improvisations. And so the actors not only know that script that is in the final performance, but they also know this huge history of generating ideas and stories that could possibly be the script.
The acting in Food Court does feel very fresh and alive. I think this is something the actors with intellectual disabilities uniquely bring to the performance. I think this is because many of us don't see actors with intellectual disabilities act very often, and we can't anticipate their physical and vocal performance the way we can anticipate a traditional actor's work. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. For me as a director, one of the important elements of creating theatre is the tension between chaos and control. There is a sense that maybe I'm watching something with actors with intellectual disabilities. Maybe this might fall apart. It's a tension that we utilise within the performance. We're very aware of the frailty. Hopefully we use it to our advantage.
In the show, there is very sparse dialogue that's spelled out for the audience with the use of subtitles. This is because the actor's speech is imperfect, yet it is perfectly suited for the play.
Pet. Bay. Cook. Ha.
The speech has so much gravity in the show, doesn't it?
It does, and it does specifically for some different actors. And when we went to make this work, we had a different agenda for each of the actors. Mark has been with the company for a long time. He's a great clown. But one of the things he does very rarely is to speak on stage. So for this work, we really had an agenda of going, let's give Mark a monologue. And that was really a huge step for him. We use subtitling that responds to his vocal performance. So it's kind of like an animation of his vocal performance.
Have any of the actors in the ensemble described to you that they can relate to what goes on in food court, that perhaps at one time or another they have fallen victim to abuse or degradation?
I think all of the actors have had some experience of some form of abuse. And when I say abuse, it's a subtle form of abuse. And it would be the nature of a relationship between a director and an actor, or a doctor and a client, or a psychologist and a client, or a teacher and a student. And these are kind of subtle forms of abuse that I think we can all draw on from civic life that we all lead. And the actors are not kind of immune to that.
You know, the play allows for dialogue about individuals with intellectual disabilities. What thoughts or debate are you instigating?
This work places disabled bodies and disabled people on that stage. It's very hard not to make the comparison between what you see there in that moment and what you know has been on those stages. I guess we propose a new image for that stage and challenge orthodoxies. And the show is really a construction to support our actors on that stage. And the audience are asked to kind of look at that and engage.
That was producer Jennifer Lynn with Bruce Gladwin, the artistic director of the Back-to-Back Theatre Company in Australia. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and like I said, this is Voices in the Family. We're talking about intellectual disabilities in light of that play Food Court. Reminder, it's coming to Philadelphia later this month at the Kimmel. I'm joined now by Celia Feinstein. She's co-executive director of the Institute on Disabilities at Temple University's College of Education. Celia, welcome.
Thank you.
Later on in the show, we're going to hear from one of her colleagues who's collecting oral histories of leaders in Pennsylvania's intellectual disability movement, and we'll talk to evolutionary psychologist Rob Kurzban. He'll chime in about how exclusive we humans can be and why we need to be exclusive in the first place. And later on, we'll be taking your calls. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. So, Celia, last year we did a show around the history of institutions for people with intellectual disabilities. In Pennsylvania, the Pennhurst, infamous Pennhurst School, which warehoused human beings, closed just 25 years ago. I mean, that's not a very long time. And now we're talking about a theatrical performance performed by people with intellectual disabilities. That's a lot of movement in 25 years. What are your thoughts about how we've gotten this far this fast?
I think it's amazing. You say this far this fast. 25 years does seem sometimes like a very long time, sometimes like it was yesterday. But I think it's such an important contribution that people with disabilities are making to the arts. And I think this is a wonderful production that will get people thinking about the perceptions about people with disabilities.
Has society shifted in their perception of people with specifically intellectual disabilities?
I think society has shifted a bit. I probably wouldn't say it shifted to where it needs to be.
Sure.
I think that 25 years ago or 50 years ago, when institutions were the form of treatment of the day, attitudes about people with intellectual disabilities were that they should be kept as far away from the rest of us as possible. I think with the closure of many institutions across the country, that's changed. There's been a slow evolution. Children with disabilities continue to be excluded from schools in ways that we wish they weren't. Adults with disabilities continue to be excluded from the workplace in ways that they shouldn't be excluded. On the other hand, I think our communities have become more accepting. People are living with families for as long as they care to, and when they no longer live with families, they live on their own or with support.
Let's talk about what we're talking about. The concept of intellectual disability really covers a wide range. So what is an intellectual disability?
I can give you the theoretical definition, which would be an IQ less than 2 deviations below the mean, less than 70, with co-occurring substantial deficits in adaptive skills. So a measured IQ that's less than 70, but also significant support needs in areas such as learning, getting from place to place, economic self-sufficiency, capacity for independent living.
So one would think that someone who has an IQ below 70 isn't necessarily capable of great insight into what's happening with them.
Oh, so untrue.
Ah.
Sorry.
That's why I presented it that way.
First of all, intellectual disability, like anything else, is different for each and every person that it affects, number one. Number two, there is a range, like there is with most ability and disability, and people fall in a variety of places in that range.
And we also know that IQ test,
yes,
measures so little.
Right. Correct.
It doesn't tell us much about much.
Correct.
You know, Celia, I have to tell you, when we spoke with you earlier, I was really surprised to hear you say that life is more difficult for people with mild intellectual disabilities. How come?
I think what we've observed in our work at the Institute, but also nationally, is that very often what happens for people with mild disabilities is that they don't admit to having a disability often, because they are quite able to pass, if you will. A famous sociologist, Robert Edgerton, wrote a book called The Cloak of Competency, where he talks about the fact that people with mild disabilities often hide their disabilities and are able to get through life quite well, thank you very much. On the other hand, I think those individuals are often the most vulnerable, because on the one hand, they're perceived to be much more capable than they are and can get themselves into trouble that way. We certainly see that in the criminal justice system, where people with disabilities find themselves in unequal proportions, as an example.
Yeah, there's a recent tragic story about that, about a young man who confessed to murder.
Well, this happens, unfortunately, more often than we'd like to know, but that's how the Institute on Disabilities first got involved in this issue. There was a young man in Aurora, Missouri, who was brought in and questioned for a murder, and he confessed to having committed the murder. Now, when you look at the transcripts of that case and you listen to them, what happened was, under interrogation, after about 7 hours, one of the detectives said, "If you just confess, then we can all go home." And he thought that meant him too. So he said, "Okay, I did it." He didn't get to go home.
People with mild intellectual disabilities, then, from what you're describing, know that they are different from others?
I think, again, there's a range of perception, of self-perception. I think there are some people that are quite aware that they're different from others, of what their limitations are, or, as I prefer to couch it, what their support needs are, what their needs are to get them through every day. There are other folks who don't quite understand the magnitude of how their disability affects them on a daily basis.
And in a way, those who do understand is more painful.
In many ways.
There are then self-esteem issues and,
yes,
and social issues.
Certainly.
Tell us about the Institute on Disabilities. You lead by example, but tell us what that means.
We are one of 67 programs funded by the Administration on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, within the Administration on Community Living, within the Department, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Quite a mouthful. We are what's called a University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities Research, Service, and Training. And we have a core mission to train the next generation of professionals in our field, to do research with and on behalf of people with disabilities and their families, to train people with disabilities and their families, to disseminate relevant research findings, and so on. So we have a very broad-based mission. Our mission is focused on people with developmental disabilities and their families.
Let's bring in a caller here. We've got Edna on the line. Hi, Edna.
Yes.
Are you there?
Hello.
Yes.
My question is, I look after two learning disabled adults. They are in retirement age. She has been not too well. They have her in a nursing home, and it's a crime that they're separated. There's no place to send people of that ilk at that age.
It is heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking. Celia, are there any resources?
Are there resources? Resources are always an issue, as you know. State budgets across 46 states are experiencing significant budget cuts in their supports to people with a variety of disabilities, not just intellectual disabilities, obviously. And so it's an issue in Pennsylvania for people with intellectual disabilities. There are services and supports available, but they're continuously being cut back, unfortunately.
So what would you say to someone who called you and asked you just the question that Edna asked? Where would you send them?
I mean, I start with sending people to make sure that people are at least registered. And in order to register for services in Pennsylvania, you register through the county where you live. And so we make sure that people are registered for services, so then they could be eligible for programs.
Where do you go register?
In Philadelphia, it's Intellectual Disability Services. Every county has a slightly different name. The state also has a toll-free number where people can ask questions and get registration information. You can also register online. I don't have the numbers in front of me.
Could you get them for us?
Yes, absolutely.
And we'll put them on our webpage.
Perfect.
Edna, we are having some resources for you. Look on our webpage, and, you know, we use the word heartbreak, but we see in Edna and her tears, and how many tears are out there for lack of resources. It's unjust. It's mm-hmm. just so unjust. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to bring in your colleague Lisa Sonnenborn, and we're going to hear more real voices. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. We're talking about intellectual disabilities. We're going to hear much more after our break. And if you want to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Like I said, I'm Dan Gottlieb, Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY-FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Do you frequently walk into a room and immediately forget why? Do you need to write things down to remember them? Is multitasking getting harder? If so, you may qualify for a research study focusing on memory in menopausal women. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness is seeking women between the ages of 45 and 60 and within 11 years of their last menstrual cycle to participate in research to study the effects of certain hormones and medication on cognition in peri- and postmenopausal women. 215-41-STUDY.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about intellectual disabilities in light of an extraordinary performance from Australia that's coming to the Kimmel this month. The cast of the show, Food Court, consists of men and women with intellectual disabilities. The subject matter centers on themes of self-loathing and rejecting others who are different. Our producer, Jennifer Lynn, had the good fortune to speak with one of the actresses. Sarah Mainwaring is a standout as the protagonist, Leslie. We've chosen to use a voiceover at times in this interview, much like Food Court relies on subtitles to relay the dialogue.
Do you enjoy being an actress?
I really do. Really fun.
I really do.
Really,
it's really fun. It's really good to let my feelings out and get to become somebody else.
Have you always wanted to be an actress?
Yes.
In the play Food Court, one of the characters, the one that you play, Leslie, is she's made to feel worthless and shamed. Does that intensity of the material in the play scare you while you're performing?
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. It empowers me and gives me strength and makes me feel stronger.
Have you ever been made to feel like the character Leslie, less of a person?
I think not to the same extent that Leslie is made to feel worthless. I haven't been made to feel so worthless that I'm not worth anything.
You're an accomplished actress. I understand you have an acquired brain injury. Are you are you comfortable being known as an actress with a brain injury, or would you prefer that you were just known for your craft, just as an actress?
I guess I feel
that I don't really want too much emphasis put on the fact that I've got a head injury. I would like more emphasis on the acting.
And Sarah, I have heard theater critics call your performance brave. Do you think you're being brave when you perform this story that shows someone being treated so poorly?
Possibly.
To some extent.
On one level.
Do you feel like an inspiration to other people who would like to try the type of acting that you do?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess.
I think you are.
I
have one more question for you. What do you want audiences to know about what it's like for you to have your particular intellectual disability? What's it like to be Sarah?
I just
want people to know, really.
I'm pretty happy.
Oh, good.
You know?
Yes, I can sense that. Hey, thank you for talking
you know.
To me. Yes. Sarah Mainwaring, thank you for taking time to talk to us. I really appreciate it. And you've done an amazing job helping to develop this play, Food Court. And we look forward to seeing it in Philadelphia. Thanks.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jennifer Lynn, for that wonderful interview with actress Sarah Mainwaring. We're having a conversation about intellectual disabilities. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I've been talking with Celia Feinstein, who's the co-executive director of the Institute on Disabilities at Temple University's College of Education. We're now joined by her colleague, Lisa Sonnenbord. She's project coordinator for a project called Visionary Voices, also at Temple. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
So tell us about Visionary Voices.
Well, Visionary Voices was actually inspired by a conversation that Celia had with two local parent advocates, I believe over breakfast at a local diner. And during the course of their conversation, what became apparent was that there are wonderful stories about the history of the intellectual disability movement, particularly the movement in Pennsylvania, that were being lost. They weren't being captured, and as people became older, we were at risk for losing those incredible stories. I was so thrilled when Celia called me and said, we really need to work to capture these stories, and that's what we do through Visionary Voices.
Mm. We just heard from Sarah Mainwaring, and although, you know, her speech is sometimes difficult to hear, she had remarkable insight into her life and it's her life's purpose. You've had dozens and dozens of interviews with people who have intellectual disabilities. Were you surprised by Sarah's mental clarity?
No, not at all. I think people with intellectual disabilities know exactly who they are and what they want from life. I think the question is, do we give them the opportunity to voice those desires? I think certainly it's the ability, even for people who don't communicate traditionally, to share with others that's most important in this conversation. Mm.
So, Celia, I guess you weren't surprised either by...
Not at all.
...by Sarah Mainwaring's clarity. Yeah. Lisa, you brought some sound clips from Visionary Voices. Let's get to them. The first one you have is from Philadelphia attorney Dennis Haggerty, who's now in his 80s. Tell us about him.
He is. Dennis is certainly a leader in the movement, both locally and nationally. Dennis, as you said, was an attorney. He's also a parent and an advocate. Dennis was involved in the movement in many ways, but perhaps most notably in the right to education. He, in collaboration with colleagues at the Pennsylvania Association for Retarded Citizens, now known as the ARC, sued the state for the right to have children educated in the public school system and saw that as a first step toward closing institutions, which is quite interesting.
You know, before we get to that clip, now that you mention the ARC, even though we don't use that word retarded anymore, but they are still around, they're vibrant, and they're a tremendous resource for people with intellectual disabilities. And I guess they're pretty easy to find online.
So they are. They have a national network and one, I believe, in every state, yes?
Yes.
So let's hear from Dennis.
When he was about 4 years old, I took him to the local pharmacy to buy hairspray from my wife, and when he went in the place, he got loose from me, and before I knew it, he had wiped out all the perfumes on the second row, and they were all over the floor. And the pharmacist, Mr. Pepper, came out and was very patient, and I thought, oh my God, this is going to cost me a bunch of money. And he was very quiet and patient and said, your boy's retarded, isn't he? And I said, yes. He said, have you ever heard of the Retarded Citizens Association? I said, no. He said, we have one in every county in Pennsylvania at a state level, and I'd like you to introduce you if you would like to do that. I said, perfect, I'd love to. Because I was looking forward to some education for my child, and finding none except in church basements where they might have a babysitting operation. And I thought anything would be better than nothing.
And because of that, his life turned to advocacy.
It did. There was nothing. There was an absence of supports and services, and it really was the connectedness of parents, I think, that spurred the movement along.
Is what pushed him along, Haggerty, was when his son was turning school age in the early 60s. Let's listen to what he had to say there. Do we have that clip? No, we don't. Oh, we didn't have that available. So we see how he was on the forefront of the intellectual disability movement and how his son helped him. And thank goodness for that pharmacist. The next clip is Kate Fiolkowski. Lisa, tell us about her.
Kate Fiolkowski is one of 11 children of Leona Fiolkowski. Leona was a parent, an advocate, and I think really a notable figure in the intellectual disability movement in the state, certainly. Parents speak of her very lovingly. Two of Leona's 11 children had significant disabilities, Walter and David, and we had the pleasure of interviewing Kate about her own experience and her mother's as well. Kate has a remarkable position in the history of the movement in that she was both a witness and a participant to her mother's story. As the youngest of 11, as Leona would march on the Capitol or argue for rights to education, she would take her four-year-old daughter along with her, as well as her two sons. She would put them in a little red wagon, put a placard on Kate, and protest for the rights that they wanted and deserved.
Well, in this clip that you brought, Kate's talking about how the right to education for those with disabilities allowed her brothers, Dave and Walter, to attend the same public school that she attended. They were pretty segregated, though, because of their disability. But in this clip, she recalls a moment when the boys were bullied by other students, and she felt afraid and powerless. Let's hear.
David and Walter, the class was going through the schoolyard to move someplace else in the school, and they were going through the schoolyard, and all of the children started chanting about the retards that were moving through the schoolroom and through the schoolyard. All the kids stopped. Do you remember this? So all the kids, you and Walter, were walking across the across the schoolyard, and all the kids stopped and started yelling and yelling and yelling at you. And it was really shocking to me, because that was the first time that I really understood the discrimination aspect of it.
When you interviewed Kate there, she was with her brother David, and he was quiet and said very little. Did you get a sense he remembered that story?
Absolutely. It was a pleasure to interview both Kate and David. David does not communicate traditionally, but he certainly communicates. And what was very interesting in working with them is that David was not only following the conversation, but his way of interjecting seemed to be in reaction to Kate. When Kate told a story that would feel a bit emotional, David would reach out and hold on to her and make eye contact with her. So he was certainly a participant in the conversation, just not in a traditional way.
What emotions get attached? We don't talk about siblings enough. You know, the helplessness and the shame, the guilt about feeling shame. There's such complex emotions, and siblings just don't have the resources we would like them to have. We've got a bunch of callers who want to join the conversation. And by the way, if you want to, our number is 888-477-9499. But let's get right to the phones. We've got Rebecca on the line. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for the show.
Sure.
I'll try to sum it up as quickly as possible, but as a former special education teacher and a lifelong strong advocate for special ed students, I recently, due to a rather serious auto accident, had a serious concussion, and as a result, I struggled and received intellectual, I'm calling it disability. Now it has really hit home, and really hit home, and the stigma I keep a secret. However, when I attempted to share it with some fellow educators, they who could have hired me said, well, you could always work in the school cafeteria. And the humiliation of that has almost silenced me to the point where what do I do now with my advocacy skills and et cetera, et cetera. And so now I'm just humiliated, I guess. That would be the word. And I'm struggling because now I'm on the other side of the fence. And so the word stigma is in capital letters.
What are you struggling with, Rebecca?
I was I could fluidly teach a class with my eyes closed. I would say I was a teacher in any special ed situation that knew how to teach well. I loved the students first, taught second. I think I was kind of unique in my style, and I taught in inner cities my whole life. My students were my best teachers, I always said. And I taught the students. I never taught to teach a test. Now, due to the accident, I had time off. Now returning, I realize I'm not as capable of handling a classroom like I did before. And what's been offered to me is almost like a handout. And I'm struggling with how to, everything from why don't you just go volunteer someplace. And now I'm fighting for me. I'll always fight for the kids, but
I'm
kind of lost in transition, I guess you'd say.
All right. And I think you called just the right number. So let's. I really want to hear from you, Celia. You're having a strong reaction as you listen to Rebecca.
Well, I think Rebecca, what you are experiencing is what people with disabilities often experience, which is a serious case of low expectations. And I think to me, there are lots of places you can go for support, not the least of which is the Disability Rights Network. Which is a place that advocates both administratively and legally for the rights of people with disabilities, with a wide variety of disabilities.
Let me ask further, though, not just about her rights, but part of her question is larger and more global. It's what now? What can I do now? What are my options? Not just legally.
Right.
Is there a place she can go to find out what's available to her?
The Office of Vocational Rehabilitation clearly has a role in helping to assess your skills as well as your needs so that they can help you figure out what the most appropriate course is for you to take. So I would definitely suggest you contact your local Office of Vocational Rehabilitation.
That's great. And Rebecca, I sure hope that's helpful, and I do wish you the best. That coming from educators, sending her to the cafeteria. Lisa, the work you're doing is really wonderful and exciting and has certainly helped enrich this show. You've got an upcoming theatrical project. Tell us about it.
Well, we're very excited, actually. As we're collecting these incredible stories of the leaders in the intellectual disability movement, the stories of parents, and particularly mothers who in the 50s and 60s envisioned a particular life for themselves and found that life significantly altered when they had a child with a disability, given the absence of choices and supports, we think is a great gateway, a great introduction to the history of the movement for people who don't think the movement is relevant to them. We have received generous funding from the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage to develop a public performance based on the stories of these women, and we have two fantastic collaborators, local director David Bradley and playwright Suli Hallam. So in the next year, we'll be doing public performances that hopefully will connect people with and without disabilities to this very rich history.
Ah, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much for your work. And thank you for joining us today. That's Lisa Sonnenborn. Lisa is the project coordinator for Visionary Voices, Leaders, Lessons, Legacy, and that's at Temple University. Celia, you're going to stay with us for the second segment, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Rob Kurzban. He is an evolutionary psychologist. We had a caller call in and wonder, why do people discriminate in the first place? And hopefully Rob will be able to answer that question for us. Well, we'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Are you frustrated with your child between the ages of 12 and 25 who is using drugs or drinking? Have you argued or pleaded with them to stop? The Family Training Program may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to attend sessions with a family specialist to help you make positive changes in your life and improve your relationship with your child. The Family Training Program is held in Philadelphia and surrounding areas by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or www.iamconcerned.org.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
Welcome back to Voice in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about intellectual disabilities, more specifically, discrimination and prejudice and what that is all about. We're going to, Celia's going to stay with us here in the studio. She's the with the Institute on Disabilities at Temple. But now we're joined by Rob Kurzban. Rob is an evolutionary psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's an associate professor at the Department of Psychology. He's written Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite, Evolution and the Modular Mind, now out in paperback. And we'd love to hear from you about this topic, 888-477-9499. Rob, are you there?
I am, and I want to thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. Listen, I give a lot of talks about disabilities and integration and all that stuff, and I make something up. I make a lot of stuff up, but one of the things I make up, I have the reason I called you in is to find out whether it's right or wrong. This is the story I tell, is that we've been discriminating since before we were in caves, and you need to survive, because we didn't know if we see something coming across is something that's going to eat us or something we can eat. So we need to be able to discriminate. Prejudice is a good thing.
Well, I was with you right up into the last thing. Depends what you mean by good, but up to there you were right, which is to say everything and every person in the landscape of every organism is either a fitness opportunity or a fitness threat or neither, and you have to deal with those things really differently, right? So you have to counter the threats, you have to take advantage of the opportunities. And so by nature, organisms are given to discriminate, then you know, your notion about good or bad has a sort of a potential moral quality to it. But I would certainly say, as a matter of sort of evolutionary fitness, it's useful to treat different organisms in your environment differently.
So the caller asked the question, why do people have such a violent reaction to others who have disabilities? And if not physically violent, emotionally violent.
Well, I mean, that's a pretty deep question, and there's a literature in psychology that struggles with this, and there's a great deal of research, and there's no sort of soundbite answer. The short version would be something like, human ancestors who kept their distance from individuals who gave off cues that they were somehow not part of the sort of typical phenotype, that is, that there was something different about them. So why would people be different? Well, it could be because they carry a disease or because they're from a different group, and so they have different norms and different styles of dress. These are all indications that this might be an individual who represents a threat as opposed to an opportunity. And I want to hastily add that by virtue of the fact that this is part of our evolutionary heritage doesn't mean that it's not something that can be changed. I think shows like this one, dramatic performances that you were discussing at the top of the show and so on, are really important. Because even though humans are evolved creatures that discriminate as part of what it means to be human, we're also social learners. We also pick up ideas from other people and adopt them. So I don't think that understanding where these things come from necessarily tells you that it's going to be something that we can't work successfully to change.
I assumed that people with disabilities were on the out group simply because they looked and acted differently, especially people who acted differently, were perceived as more of a threat.
Right. So people disagree about this. I mean, one way to think about it is that things that are dangerous are things that are difficult to predict. If you can't predict what another individual is going to do, then it's hard to evade them. It's hard to exactly figure out how to deal with them. And I think one thing, and this comes out a little bit in some of the discussions, is that people aren't necessarily accustomed to these individuals. They don't do things in the same way that we're used to. And again, this applies as much to people from, say, foreign cultures as it does to people with different disabilities. And again, so this lack of predictability that can promote fear or anxiety, and that can turn into anger, at least avoidance, if not aggression or exploitation. And so these are the things I think that we need to be aware of, is that you can have these emotional reactions, but then again, as I was saying earlier, that's not necessarily going to be the sole determinant of the way you interact with them.
Yeah, one of the things I talk about, and I think is very important, is for people to tolerate their own intolerance. And here's what I mean. If we have a negative reaction, judgmental, critical, towards someone, there's a way in which that is normal and natural, and we shouldn't judge ourselves harshly, nor should we act on it. You know, it's just a natural reaction that we need to understand and grow out of, or tolerate.
I think that's an excellent point. I think there are many ways in which there are going to be certain kinds of reactions that we simply can't avoid. So, you know, even if you're expecting it, someone fires off a pistol in front of you, you're gonna jump back, and that's okay. And then if you take the equivalent in these other interactions, I think being aware of these kinds of ways in which we all are going to be disposed towards other individuals, and then, again, working hard to overcome them, I think that's perfectly fine. But as you say, I think awareness is sort of the first step. And again, some of the things you're talking about earlier in the show I think are important, which is that, we need to understand that there has been this history in this country and elsewhere that we're starting to change now, and I think that's a very positive thing, the steps that we've taken, and that doesn't mean that there's not more work to be done.
Yeah, I don't want to say just in this country and elsewhere. All of this really started in Pennsylvania. You know, the first President Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it was based on the impetus of his Governor Dick Thornburgh, who was in his administration, who was governor of Pennsylvania, based on his son with a disability. So we are really at the forefront of making progress. I sure hope we stay there. I have to mention something that just happened last week, speaking of violent reactions to those with disabilities. Last week in Newark, American Airlines refused to let a family fly because their son with Down syndrome, they said, was a flight risk. Now, this is a violent reaction to a nonviolent child.
I find that puzzling. I mean, one of the tensions that I think, you know, we face is that there is this issue of liberty, and then there's this issue of what economists would call externalities, the cost that people impose on other people as a side effect. And we all admit them, right? So when I drive in downtown Philadelphia, that makes it all the much harder for other people to get where they're going. It's not because I want to slow people down. And I think this is where it comes back to tolerance, which is that, you know, I think as a society, we need to be tolerant of the fact that, you know, there are people who are going to require consuming more public goods than others. And I think one of the things that it means to be in the kind of society that we've chosen to live in is to be ready to pay those costs. And as you're saying, you know, understanding where your reaction comes from might have helped those folks on American Airlines or TSA, whoever it was, and to think about it a little bit more analytically.
And I think it would help our society be more humane and civil in general. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end on that note. I am so grateful to all my guests for what you do and for what you've brought to the show. We've been talking about intellectual disabilities, and our guests have been Celia Feinstein, Lisa Sonnenbort, and Rob Kurzban. We also heard from Bruce Gladwin and Sarah Mainwaring of Back to Back Theater Company. I'm going to be leading a discussion about intellectual disabilities and inclusion on Saturday, September 22nd, following their 8 p.m. performance of Food Court at the Kimmel. I sure hope to see you there. Well, you can comment on today's show by going to whyy.org, and you can download our shows there or on iTunes. Listen, I just want to thank you all for your support during my recovery from some pretty grueling surgery and all that time in bed. You know, the doctor said I actually healed about 10 days to 2 weeks ahead of schedule, and I think that's because of a lot of factors, but I know one of them was because of your love and support, and I am so deeply grateful to all my listeners for that and so many other things. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Joshua Rafeman is our new intern. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.